Well, hello and welcome, Hacker Public Radio listeners, to another Phoenix's Student Hacker's Guide to Linux. Well, it's another interview this month. I was very lucky enough to hop on Skype and speak to Pete Wood from First Biggs Technologies. It was a very interesting time. I had the benefit of listening to Pete Wood speak before. I enjoyed it very much. But enough of me, and let's get on with the interview. I'll catch you all again next time on Hacker Public Radio. Hello, Hacker Public Radio listeners. I'm having a conversation with Pete Woods. Pete, could you introduce yourself to the Hacker Public Radio audience?
Yeah, with pleasure. Hi, I'm Peter Wood. I'm founder and chief of operations at First Base Technologies, which is an ethical hacking firm founded back in 1989 when nobody knew what it was. And I'm also a conference committee member for ISARCA, the audit institute.
Okay, thanks very much for joining us, Pete. It's a real pleasure to speak to you. I was lucky enough to see you talk at my university last year, I'm really glad to have got you on. I suppose one of my first questions for you is, what's your advice for people getting into ethical hacking?
Oh, there's an interesting question. I think we've done quite a bit of interviewing over the years. You can imagine we get quite a lot of people approaching us who are interested in the whole profession. And I guess I've got a few comments. The first is really to understand that it's not just about technical skills, unless you're going to be a backroom person or a researcher working for government, I guess, or something like that. But one of the key factors, I think, is being able to think outside the box. I know that's a really boring thing to say, and I might even be quoting someone else in the information security community in saying that, someone who stands on stages an awful lot and says that, but it's true. You need to look at things, in my terms, I think, like a combination of an engineer and a child. You have to say, what happens if I do this? Not, you know, a number of people of my age who aren't techies who tell me that their kids end up pressing every button on some device or other and they can never get it back to normal. Or if it is screwed, then they have to get their kids to sort it out for them. Well, hackers, I think, if we're talking about the sort of job that you and I do, they're the ones that can do that as if they were a seven-year-old but with an engineering head on, which is an interesting blend, I think. Possibly the fact I've never had any kids has left me childish, but anyway, it works for me.
So kind of this schizophrenic state of being engineer plus tank, you know, playing around.
Yeah, well, it's no different than when I was like 7 years old and wiring up stuff. I blew myself across the room putting a 12-volt torch bulb into a plug when I was seven. And stuff like that, I think. If you survive it anyway, can give you the right skill set.
I think I was about the same age when I got electrocuted with 240 volts out of the house. So,
have you found you get immune to
that? I think it's probably your right. And once you're shocked,
yeah,
you're shocked.
I used to use it just to keep everything going on a daily basis at one point, but that was working on a test bench. At the same time, though, I think obviously you've got to be ethical and professional. That comes with the job title, but it's something that people don't understand fully, I think.
I don't think people appreciate that so much, that we have to be good, we have to be the white hats, we have to be the good guys, and that means keeping ourselves whiter than white, because the road to grey, and then the road from grey to black is I think is a quick and slippery road, to be honest.
It is, and I've seen it with a lot of people I've spoken to, and they don't quite understand where the boundary is, and it sounds horribly boring and a bit starched to say that, you know, we don't touch anything unless either we built it ourselves for that purpose, or if we've got the bit of paper that says that we're allowed to do it. But in fact, it's a lot more fun if you have permission, in a way, because you end up being able to explore things without fear of being captured, and you actually get in a lot deeper, a lot quicker. And
so it kind of helps your creative impulse, really, knowing that your boundaries, you're free within the boundaries that
you've set. Yeah, and that was my next point. In fact, you've hit the very word, which is the boundaries, because where we have had problems with people that we've trialed or that we've interviewed, it's that they don't understand the boundaries properly. And obviously there's a huge amount of boring work in discussing this with the client at the start of the engagement and saying, these are the sort of things that we want to do, and then explaining to them the potential impact to make sure that we don't, for example, run exploits against a system that's critical to their business during working hours or something of that nature. It sounds obvious.
It's basically it's the trust thing, though, isn't it? You know, you're asking people to trust you, and if you're asking people to trust you, then you have to stick to your word.
Mm. I mean, it's like having a house guest, isn't it? And agreeing in principle what the boundaries are, and then finding that they've, I don't know, drunk all your beer or something,
and not replaced.
Exactly. And of course, that requires discipline. And one of the things I find absent in some people who talk to us about a job is understanding exactly what that discipline is, because you might be really keen to explore something that you've noted. But our stance is, when you find something like that, you go and talk to the client about it. This is assuming you're on site, or you phone them up if you're not. And you talk it through with them and say, look, we could do this, what do you think? And in those situations, we have a sort of additional consent form that we use. And if the client agrees that that particular system is worth digging into in more depth, then we get them to sign off for that specifically. And that way we keep everybody on the same page and everybody legal.
Do you think in that case, do many companies kind of take you up on that, or do they, if you find a new vulnerability or in a system that they didn't expect, do you find that they're proactive with you, or do you find that they kind of say, no, it's okay, we only want you here for this?
It's a cultural thing, of course. In there are many firms that are more formal than others. And some of it is interesting, actually, given who I'm talking to, but one of the most interactive and creative clients we dealt with is based in Edinburgh, and they're in the investment side of things. And they're very intelligent. We sit down and talk with them about what we found. All the IoT guys engage with it, and we dig into it a bit further, almost as a cooperative team. Other firms we deal with literally just want, in effect, a kind of vulnerability profile, and are very nervous about anything that's proactive or penetrative. And so, it's a cultural thing.
I think, I've been lucky to listen to some of the podcast stuff that you've done before and read some of the stuff you've done, and I've heard you talk about certain institutes, you know, typically institutes that are aware of security, have been institutes or companies that have been aware of security for years and years and years, almost like the physical security. I've heard you kind of, you know, mention that banks are so used to guarding their property that it's come second nature to them. Whereas maybe an insurance company are maybe not so, you know, are not in the business of asking people who they are at the door and that sort of thing.
You're right, and that's particularly true of any organisation that started up since we've really been using the web so aggressively. Firms that we've dealt with who are not so established, if you like, I mean, maybe been running for 10 years or so, and have a very web-based mindset, or their client interface is electronic, their understanding of physical security is near zero very often.
Well, I mean, I think that the example of that is, you know, when you've got a bank, they've been used to guarding cash for years and years and years. Do you know, if you've not got a company that's not actually had to guard something, physically guard something, then I think that's probably that difference line.
Yeah, you know? And that and all the damn outsourcing and side sourcing and whatever sourcing it is. Because the more different players there are involved, the less personal responsibility people take for things, and that seems to cause a lot of problems. You know, we've done tests on site for banks who, like most large organisations these days, have done an outsourcing agreement to look after their IT infrastructure, or an outsourcing agreement to develop software, or both. And whilst the employees of the institution are solid, we very frequently find that the third parties that they've involved are not. And you would hope, you know, if you were a large organization and you were providing these services as a mainstream business, that you'd understand security, but honestly, they really don't.
I mean, would it be fair in some ways to suggest that maybe some of the technology companies are not, maybe don't think in security, maybe they just think so much in technology that technology, let's get our product out there, let's sell it on the internet, let's do this, let's do that, that they maybe don't think about, you know, the enemy within, with the USB stick taking customer databases?
Oh, sure. I think that's interestingly true about almost all businesses, I think. If you're physically inside the building, you're okay, whether you're a member of staff or not. And there isn't, I mean, I don't think I've found very many companies, I can think of maybe one or two, who defend their internal network adequately. I don't think anybody wants to make it unusable, but, you know, their physical and their technical controls internally are usually, well, I can't think of another word other than pathetic. I rant about this a lot when I'm giving presentations and doing talks and webinars and things. It's frustrating because, in some respects, it doesn't stretch us very much. Mm-hmm. And that sounds a bit selfish, but it's true.
I wanted to kind of just jump back to something that you said earlier on, you know, with companies outsourcing their IT. How much does that actually impact when you go and do a test? Because obviously your permission's for the company that you're testing, but does your permit? I'm sure your permission probably doesn't jump the boundaries to a third party supplying IT services.
Well, the stance we have on this is to make sure we involve all parties in the consent process. You know, if we've got a bank who've asked us to run tests, and we ask them to make sure that they discuss what's going to happen with their providers, so that they know what's going on as well. Having said that, of course, usually they're not all that cooperative. They don't like it very much because they're concerned that they'll get exposed, which usually they are. But you know, we can't test something that isn't owned by the company who's engaged us. So, you know, if we're working in a hosting environment, for example, we have to work closely with the hosting firm as well to make sure we're not touching something that belongs to another of their clients.
I suppose as well. Yeah, I suppose as well when you, when you have their client coming back to them and saying, "We really want to do a security test. This is important to us. We need you to sign the consent." I'm presuming if they turn around and say, "No, we're not letting you test our security," I can imagine that makes the wheels turn within that organisation and saying, "Oh, you know, are we getting value for service? We can't even test if our systems are secure anymore."
So almost
customer pressure might push, you know, these third party suppliers to be a little bit more helpful.
Yeah, I think that one of the difficulties is that people asking us to actually conduct the tests are typically in audit or security departments, and the people who engage the third party, the outsourcing firm, are not. And you get into a kind of a political scenario where the security people within the organisation, within the client, are typically perceived to be paid anyway, because of course they're getting in the way of business as usual in a lot of business people's minds. And if they start complaining about the outsourcing as well, frequently not very much happens, unfortunately. And one example was one of our bigger clients. We're talking about a multinational with several billion pounds turnover, and they were looking at outsourcing their wide area network, which covered a large number of countries, and they asked us to review the submissions by four different tendering organisations against what we consider to be best practice from a security point of view, encompassing things like the ISO 27000 standards and policies and procedures, as well as technical controls. And we gave them a very thorough report, and we ranked the submissions, and we gave a commentary on each, including very much a sort of startup, not very professional organisation. Guess which one they went for?
The non-professional, I imagine.
Yeah, the cheapest.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's... I've spoken to a few people in this kind of this mini-series thing that's going on, and it seems to be that this theme that kind of rolls through everyone, that, you know, companies keep on putting price over security. And I think, I think the one thing that we all champion is you can't put a price on decent security.
No, I mean, it's got to be reasonable. You've got to have some sort of balance there. I mean, we do too, of course, even though we're a small organisation. You know, we have to look at this on a regular basis because we have to try and walk the walk.
Mm-hmm.
And there are costs that I know a lot of small firms of our size wouldn't bear, which we do because we feel it's essential. But honestly, in the end, decent quality security isn't any more expensive if it's done properly, because it's all about doing a proper job anyway in engineering terms. And getting the staff involved in security and having them understand what it means to, you know, not give out phone numbers willy-nilly, or to challenge people when they arrive at the front door. They actually enjoy it. They actually feel as though they're contributing. They are, without question, the first and most important line of defense.
Mm-hmm.
They self-correct. I listen to our team, you know, and there's only 10 of us, but I listen to our team discussing things and correcting a new member of staff who hasn't locked his desk drawers at night or has left the USB stick on the desk or something. You know, we don't hardly have to police it at all, because the team looks after itself.
So do you
I know everybody will say that's much easier in a small team, and of course it is. But in the end, big organisations are just groups of small teams.
So do you think that it would maybe be fair to suggest that companies that have maybe been on the receiving end of security breaches and are probably more prepared to kind of think about better security than companies that have never experienced a security breach?
Without question.
Mm-hmm. And do you
the most common reason we're asked to do a social engineering test is because someone in the organisation, the most recent one was a chief exec, which is very flattering, want to make a demonstration to convince their staff how vulnerable they are. Because in the end, of course, a good criminal social engineer will never be detected. So, you know, when firms say they've never had an incident, of course, they don't actually know.
Well, the great thing with social engineering is that the great ones don't get caught, the other ones are in jail. They're out of circulation.
Don't tell that to Kevin Mitnick, he'd be really fed up, but I think you're right.
Yeah, I spoke about this on the last interview. Did you hear about Kevin Mitnick and Facebook?
No.
He got blocked off Facebook and couldn't get his account re-enabled. He'd registered with a false name for security purposes.
Of course.
And they went through and checked all the details. Because he's calling as Kevin Mitnick, well, the registrar of the account was under a different name. And he was saying, you know, it's quite ironic that I spent most of my life being able to quite convincingly get people to believe I'm not who, you know, I am who I say I am, and now I need to prove I am who I am. I'm having problems doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, he managed to get it redone again. But you know, for the Hacker Public Radio listeners that haven't heard of Kevin Mitnick was, you know, he's probably a god to anyone who appreciates social engineering. I mean, the guy was, you know, never mind his technical ability, but his, you know, his social engineering abilities, well known, and I think he's written a book as well on it. So to say he's actually on the receiving end of this, most of us in the security industry find it quite funny.
Yeah, absolutely.
I suppose the other question that I would ask in kind of tow with the companies that have experienced breaches compared to the companies that haven't, do you think that companies that have thought about, you know, network security and internet security and dare I say penetration and testing and all of this are far more prepared when it comes to an incident happening than a company that doesn't invest any time into it?
Yeah, I guess so. My experience is that most firms suffer from being large and from a staff turnover that's quite fast these days. I mean, we haven't had anybody leave the firm since, well, I don't know, 2001. And we've got a team that enjoys working together, but in a big firm, you've got a very rapid turnover of staff. And that causes a problem, because lessons learned disappear when people leave. It's particularly and especially true at the board level and C-suite level, because if you get a senior person who understands the issues and has, you know, pushed security down the stack and put real effort into it, if they leave and go to another firm, things tend to just flop back into a much more casual and less professional state in pretty much any firm I've looked at.
So, I mean, what would your advice be for organisations, you know, with their staff? I mean, my views are on it that you know, security training is something that's not going to take half an hour in the afternoon, and it has to be done properly. You know, I I've seen some of these companies and their ideas of security training is rather worrying, you know, 20 minutes before lunch.
And that's the
problem. And how much, you know, what sort of advice would you give for organizations that are wanting to increase their security?
Yeah, they have a real challenge because, you know, human beings don't like it. That's the bottom line. Human beings like to be friendly. They like to be trusting. It's built into our nature. And I don't think we could live with the population density we have if we weren't, in fact, very sociable, very easygoing animals. And to try and counter that, or not counter it, but to try and open people's eyes to what's good practice is very difficult because it isn't in society at all. You know, people learn to lock their houses and they learn to lock their cars. That's a kind of social pressure as much as it is intelligence. Companies have things like that yet.
Do you think demonstrations are maybe more of an effective means of proving your point?
No question. That's an excellent point. One of my favourite demos is a laptop hack. You know, the average, well, we still see it that way in the press. If somebody loses a laptop, there was one last week, I can't remember who it was, and it was a council, I think, and they said it was the laptop was password protected. Well, we know that it's running Windows because it's a corporate laptop. And we know that, you and I know anyway, that if you take a Windows laptop and you set it up with Windows and you don't protect it in any other way, you've got a situation where any hacker who's able to do a bit of research on the web, who's able to just look for a...
Let's put it even honestly, anyone who can download an ISO,
exactly.
Long and short of it, anyone who can born it.
I proved this to a client the other day, because they were talking about this, and we were debating the benefits of whole disk encryption, and I said, go to Google, type in crack my Windows password, and look at the results, and they did. And they were convinced because they'd never done that. They don't think like a hacker. They hadn't thought about those things. But of course, immediately they get links to Offcrack, to the NTFS reader software, that sort of stuff. And they then realise they can download an ISO burner CD, and immediately they've got access to the laptop. And you know, the problem is that people who are interested, like you and I, people who want to make money from it, only need to spend a few minutes learning how to do it, and wham bam, they own the laptop. So I demonstrate that. Usually it takes about 20 minutes, half an hour to go through it all, including explaining it in words of one syllable.
Yeah.
I did a demo for the BBC recently, where I installed a Trojan on journalist's laptop, which he left with me for 20 minutes. He then went home, and I remote controlled his laptop for him, showed him screenshots of him accessing his email, got his password for his horrible Google thing, which is pretty insecure, you know, where he's got all his diary and emails and everything. And he was just amazed. And yet, you know, to people in the profession, it's second nature. But for the average Joe out there, they've got no idea at all. So a demo like that just completely changes the organisation's attitude to something like laptop security. And it's the same thing when we walk into a building, hopefully. We can demonstrate that no one challenges you, no one asks to see your badge, nobody asks why you're sitting in a meeting room with your laptop plugged in. You know, we do it over and over and over again. But I'm trying desperately to do as many of these demonstrations and talks to the general public as I can, as well as to specific clients, because
it's
the only way to get people to think about it.
The one thing that I champion all the time is that, you know, we've tried lots of different means, and I really think that the proof's in the pudding. I think the only way that now that we can convince people of the implications is to keep on demonstrating them.
Yeah.
You know, and not just look like this techno geek, this wizard, but show them, look, this is Google, you use it every day, type in this term, look at what you find.
Yeah, you know, I agree so strongly. I've never tried to put myself forward as a, you know, as a really technical person, although there's elements of that I love and can do. the work I'm doing in terms of public speaking and so on isn't about, you know, although I love doing it, and of course you get your ego stroke from doing it, but, you know, it's not about hairy chest, bloody supersonic, very clever scripting, whatever. It's, oh, look, I walked into your building, I picked up this laptop, I inserted a Trojan in it, and now I control your network remotely. I did this just by doing this, 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 and this. Look, nothing clever. Make myself a fake big British Telecom pass, you know, which takes, what, well, last time I aged it a bit as well, put it in the washing machine and things, but it looked more convincing that way. But, you know, it didn't take very long. And obviously the tools are out there, as we've both just said, you know, just for the helping yourself. And the problem is, it's thinking outside the box again, isn't it? People who are working in the corporate, who have a professional job in security, may understand this, but everybody else in the company doesn't. They don't ever go on to Google and type crack my Windows password unless they've got the intention of doing something criminal.
Yeah, I think people are just shocked by the plethora of information that's available. I think education is a critical thing, because in reality, people do need to start taking responsibility for their own security. And I understand that sounds like a daunting task at first, but really it's about a mindset. And I think that, in, you know, being a benefit of doing a degree in ethical hacking, I think it's hard to teach everyone all the technical aspects of hacking. It's about teaching a mindset. And like everyone I've spoken to has indicated that this isn't a 9-to-5 job, that it's about playing around and reading blog posts and asking a question and finding the answer out till the bitter end.
It's a lifestyle.
Yeah, it's a choice.
You know, I see it as a vocation, and I think it's important because, you know, in the last, although I've been doing it for 20 years, in the last 10, it's become a real and present danger for citizens as well as for businesses. And, you know, a lot of the talks I give are to people who, you know, come from every walk of life, and I show them about, you know, how phishing scam works, how drive-by website infections work, what they haven't updated when they think they have, why they should have a personal firewall, all stuff that's second nature to people in our profession, but which, you know, it seems the average person has just no idea about at all. And if they do have an idea, it's usually wrong.
Yeah, I've seen people who haven't been running, you know, home users that haven't been running firewalls or antiviruses, have been running a straight Windows box connected to the internet. And you know that in reality there is thousands and thousands and thousands of people that are doing the same thing. Or if they are running an antivirus, it's the 90-day trial that they got with their, when they bought their laptop, and they're sitting there in the wrong belief that they're protected against, you know, intrusions, and it's scary.
The most successful of our clients, who, in terms of security awareness for their staff, have taken a stance, and there are two I'm thinking of here, of running awareness sessions for their staff, which are focused on them being secure at home. And there's immediate benefit and enthusiasm amongst those users, because they have their eyes opened as to what is a strong Windows password. They have their eyes opened about things like antivirus and personal firewalls and so on. And when they see the direct benefits to them in the home environment, they transfer those skills into the workplace.
It's one of my favorite demonstrations. I love doing the rainbow table hacks because it's such a good way of delivering the importance of password security. And that's such an easy one for people to implement, and yet the ramifications of decent password security, you know, it's just, you know, if more people use stronger passwords, we'd be a lot more secure.
Yeah, well, I've never yet found an audience member amongst IT professionals who understands why your Windows password has to be longer than 14 characters, for example, how long it could be, how to make a passphrase, why it's more secure, what rainbow tables are. And I'm talking about some of the biggest firms in the UK and Europe, and we're talking about professional IT people. And I'm not saying none of them know, that's not my point, but I've never had an audience member who could answer the question. and who understood it. And we did a 45-minute session on passwords with a big chunk of it about Windows LAN manager hashes and why those are an issue. And it's just opened people's eyes every time we've talked about it and every time we demonstrated that sort of rainbow table attack. And they had no idea that Windows works that way.
And that's just one vulnerability in it. I mean, even without Landman, you know, the fact that people use unsecure passwords, it doesn't matter what you use to encrypt it, you can just sit there and start guessing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I should say it's a very, very rare Windows network that we meet that we can't guess a domain admin level password just by using our brains.
Well, I was lucky enough to, well, not lucky enough, I suppose, but I worked for a large ISP over the summer. And their password security scared the living daylights out of me. Really scared me.
You find the same thing in every firm, mate. Everywhere we go where we do an internal network test.
But this wasn't just a case of it being internal. It was a technical desk. These people were also, by proxy, passing on that poor password security onto all of those customers. And this is the way, you know, that scared the living daylights out of me. And when you have, you know, when you have a trainer turning around to you and saying, "My God, that's a long password," you sit there and think, you know, but you're in charge of teaching these people how to teach customers what password security is. Turning around and saying, "My God, that's a long password," that, you know, it quite clearly shows that you don't understand why it's a long password.
I agree.
You know, if I saw someone typing a long password, it'd be like, "Oh, that's secure." You know, but we're brought up in that mindset.
Yeah.
I mean, kind of, what do you see as like your biggest security fear?
Well-designed Trojans.
Well-designed Trojans.
Yeah.
I'm a big rootkit fan myself, but Trojans. I was, my lecturer, I believe he was at, you know, one of your White Hat talks, and he was talking to the guy from Microsoft, who was saying that there's been a sharp decrease in the amount of viruses and a sharp increase in the amount of Trojan/malware software coming out. And I thought
that just
beautifully showed that how commercial hacking has become now. You know, it's just,
without question, I think, you know, it's horrifying how ill-defended most organisations are against things like that. It's really, really naughty. But they're just such an easy, low-risk, high-return route for a criminal that I think that's going to be the growth area in the next couple of years. There's very clever programmers out there, very clever.
And it does show kind of the difference in the mindset, where it's, you know, in the commercial aspect of it, it's producing a piece of software that's going to infect as many people as possible in the shortest amount of time. Whereas probably a geeky hacker like myself, I'm a big rootkit fan, but there's no legs in producing a state-of-the-art rootkit, because that's such a specialized infection that you're going for there. You know, when you're doing the Trojan, you're going to put it in a bit of software, screensaver, or so on and so forth. You know,
I think we both know someone who's done work on obfuscating Trojans, and, you know, just making them invisible to antivirus for long enough.
There's such an amount of information out on the internet on doing this as well. You know, it's scary.
That's my real concern, because most of my clients aren't properly defended against this. Again, it's, in my opinion, the first line defence is a well-educated member of staff.
Uh-huh.
You know, just not going to fall for this. Did you see the zero day that just came out for PowerPoint?
I have seen it, yes.
Yeah, I mean, things like that, you know, I'm still getting people sending me PowerPoints as joke attachments, you know, that sort of stuff. I can just imagine how prevalent that is.
I mean, I, you know, I've touched on this on a couple of a few other people that I've spoken to, and it seems to be the year of 0 days. I think if that term is ever going to get coined and people in the street are going to start using it, I think it's going to happen this year. Because if you just think that we're in April, the amount of widespread 0 days that we've had is just very, very public as well.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, whilst we still see huge numbers of businesses as well as home users who are patched up to date, patching is still, you know, pushed as one of the key things you need to do, and of course it is. But, you know, it just ain't enough. People don't patch their applications in the same way as they do their operating systems. And anyway, more, as you say, more and more exploits are coming out for which there isn't a fix. And the only solution is, you know, hygienic practice on behalf of the user.
Yeah, there's a lot of education in doing that, though.
There is. It's a terrifying job, but I mean, it's the only way to do it, I think.
Do you see Trojans being? I mean, I suppose you said yes to this, really. But I mean, the question I suppose I'm trying to ask is, you know, what do you see as the biggest one in the future, and the biggest security threat in the future, and Trojans being one of them. But do you see anything else, you know, starting to compete with Trojans as a threat?
I think it's all linked with social engineering in the end. You know, I actually watched a webcast a couple of weeks ago, which I can't remember who it was, but they talked through their view that there's a cycle of hacking activities that they hadn't much proof for it, I have to say, because if it is a cycle, it's only gone round once. But it started with social engineering, the sort of stuff we saw with Mitnick and with the Legion of Doom and all those guys back in the 80s. And then, you know, when we got more connectivity, it moved to, you know, online hacking. And when people started beefing up their firewalls and doing a proper job, it moved to web application hacking. And, of course, that's still huge as well. But as people finally start to learn about how to build a reasonably secure web service, although I don't think it'll ever be secure, then it moves on again. And I can't remember all the points on that cycle that they claimed, but I could see the logic of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in effect, there was like a huge gold rush of opportunity when we all started using the internet aggressively in commerce. And as that whole learning cycle for businesses has happened, and people have spent a lot of money on silver bullets to fix their electronic vulnerabilities, if you like, it just becomes a natural part of criminal thinking to start to introduce some part of human trickery into the process. And that's really what social engineering is in the end, isn't it? And whether it's by email or website or telephone or on-site, you know, some degree of exploiting human trust and exploiting human, gullibility will always remain, I think, a key factor in criminal activity. And that's what we're seeing. It's getting more and more sophisticated. It's a hugely complex blend of social manipulation and clever software. Stuff like the Flash Player movie that uses UPnP to access your broadband router and open its management ports onto the internet side and stuff like that. Really complex and clever stuff that most people have no hope of understanding, but all hinged on people being gullible because, oh, look, nude celebrity photos, or, oh, look, somebody fancies you. This is really funny. Look how stupid Gordon Brown is, or whatever the trigger is. People will continue to fall for that.
I think when I was speaking to Chris John Riley, you know, he made the great point about when you actually think about our industry, you know, hacking as a whole, you have us, you have the white hats that are paid to find vulnerabilities, exploit them, prove them and patch them and get paid for it. And then you look at, you know, the black hats who are paid to find vulnerabilities, exploit them, use them and get paid for it. It's, you know, if for everyone that we've got trying to fix a problem, there's someone just as technically gifted trying to find a new one. So it's a very...
Yeah, and the criminals give much more time to it than the majority of defenders.
I mean, who do you see as being probably the biggest, you know, who would you say was your hero in hacking that kind of really fired your imagination to get involved in this whole industry?
That's a lovely question, isn't it? Because you gave me some heads up on this, I had a good think about it yesterday. Actually, the book that really inspired me, in which I continue to make required reading, it's the only required reading for anybody who joins our firm, is Cliff Stoll's The Cuckoo's Egg. And I know Clifford Stoll was not technically a hacker, although a lot of his activities became very white hat hacking defense. But that whole book told me more about the evil hacker mindset and the mechanisms and the dedication needed to counter it. It's taught everyone who's joined our firm who maybe hasn't been involved in security before, because we tend to take, you know, people who are competent in their field and then train them in the hacking mindset. It's the one thing that triggers everybody's head. And if any of the listeners haven't read Clifford Stoll's The Cuckoo's Egg, I couldn't recommend it more.
Superb. I mean, I suppose you can't ask about heroes without asking about villains. Who would you think's your biggest hacking villain?
Yeah, I thought about that one too, and I have to say, I'll give you a trite answer, I'm afraid. That's any of the criminals out there at the moment who are making everybody's use of the internet a misery. I don't think, you know, in terms of bad guys, that it's very easy to really see through the media hype as to how really naughty they were. When I met Kevin Paulson and had a matter with him a few years ago, he was pretty naughty, because, I mean, he used, again, social engineering techniques, primarily, and a bit of technology to make money for himself and rip off a radio station and stuff. But in the global picture, it's chicken feed, isn't it? There are people out there developing really clever software, some of which is really devious and nasty, but I don't think we'll ever know who they really are, not on a personality level. So for me, it's the criminalization of a technology that you and I are both in love with, I think, that really chooses.
Yeah, me. I mean, the bit that irks me the most about it is, I'm going off on a side tangent about it here, it's the disclosure aspect that, you know, villains never disclose what they find because it's to their profit, you know. Mm. And the problem is, hero-wise as well, you know, how much are they disclosing as well? And it goes back to that education point that, you know, we need to disclose these vulnerabilities, but it's not in the best interest of a villain. It's not in their, you know, it's not, they're not, you know, it loses them their paycheck. And which...
Yeah,
you know, and I think that's probably the importance of honeypots and stuff like that, is to actually watch these people on in their own ground and see what they're, you know, see what they're bringing out and what they're trying.
Yeah, I saw I'm thinking of one very clever person, Joanna Rakowska, who's the Polish hacker, and she's a security researcher. I've shared a platform with her at conferences, and I've had some degree of conversation with her, and certainly last time I talked to her, which was a couple of years ago now perhaps, her attitude on disclosure was not mine, shall we say. And you know, she's done some very clever things, like the blue pill attacks and all kinds of clever stuff in terms of, you know, BIOS and things. And she actually said that people who didn't, this was at a conference from the platform, she said people that didn't patch up to date and think about these things were stupid and deserved to be hacked.
It's the
and my mate Fred Piper was in the audience, and Fred said, you know, if I can't speak Russian, does that make me stupid? And she didn't really answer the question. He said, this is ignorance, not stupidity. And it's our job to educate people and to raise their awareness so that they can help defend themselves. But, you know, just because you're a ninja in a particular area doesn't give you the right to A, diss everybody else who isn't, and B, to reveal to the world attacks which may otherwise never have been found by criminals, or certainly would expedite criminal activity without taking a responsible line on it. Now, I don't know if she still thinks like that, and I'm not trying to do any character assassination, but her attitude at that time did worry me.
So do you... Let's say that you discovered something. I mean, my views on disclosure are such that if you do find something, that you need to give the parties involved adequate time to come to a solution to fix it.
We have a very straightforward approach to that. We report any vulnerabilities we find to CPNI, and CPNI contact the manufacturers on our behalf, and they deal with it and they get the resolution. And I have to say, you know, so far the results have been very positive.
Yeah, I mean, to my views are, you know, to get all of the parties involved and give them the chance to fix the problem. But I, you know, the there is aspects where, you know, you worry about organisations that, you know, don't take the warning. Say we found something that's pretty serious, we need to work away fixing it, and just ignore it.
I don't think we involve I don't think we involve. This could be this just personal opinion. Although as a founder of the company, I guess it's company's opinion as well. A lot of people don't involve legitimate channels as leverage in the way that we try to. We try to use, you know, government agencies to bring pressure to bear on the authors and manufacturers. And that's, I think, likely to be a lot more successful than a lone voice.
I think this year as well, we've also seen an increase in different techniques in disclosing vulnerabilities. I can't remember the incident directly, but I think it was to do with security certificates, that how they did a disclosure. They disclosed it to basically all the major users of the security certificates, and then disclosed it to the security certificate producers at the last moment.
Yeah.
But that was a lot to do with a fear of them being shut down before the information came out, and rather than the vendors of this technology, a fear that those vendors, rather than patch it, would silence them. And that they'd use this process instead to disclose this information. And it seemed to me that it was very OTT, but I could also see why maybe using that process was the best, you know, was best for that, you know, best for that solution. What would you, I sort of asked you this before, but what would you say your top security tip is for people listening today then?
What, for home
users?
Yeah,
for home users and...
for home users, I say don't click on it and don't open it.
I have another couple of quick questions for you. I'm really looking forward to the answer to this one, but what's your most memorable security incident?
Oh, that was the first time that I walked into an organisation straight past reception. Walked into a meeting room, plugged in my laptop, got Windows domain admin privilege, and sucked everything off the network in the total of 5 minutes.
Was your heart pounding? Heart pounding?
A bit. Although I detach a little bit when I'm doing it. I think it's like an actor. You know, you take yourself into another personality. It's afterwards that it hits me, usually. But that first time was, of course, then the first of many. But the first time I did it, I just couldn't believe how soft organisations are in that sense. Obviously, I can't tell you who it was, but you know, it's happened in every sector that we do business with. It's really worrying. That was a very exciting day. Yeah, you're right. And I also realised that it was something that I needed to really focus on, to really campaign about, because, you know, there's enough people out there campaigning about security, there's enough people out there campaigning to sell product and, you know, flashy blue lights and nice sexy front panels and things. But it's not such a popular area, because you can't make lots of money doing it. You can't sell sexy silver bullet solutions for this. You know, you have to encourage organisations to do deep vetting, to for their key staff. You have to encourage organisations to understand that IT admins have access to everything automatically. You have to encourage them to invest a lot of time and effort in staff education in a very creative way, and they don't like to do it because it's difficult.
Well, it's different. It's a change.
It involves lots of people.
You know, you're asking people to change, and change is always... people are never very happy with change, are they?
No, it's much nicer to go out and buy the latest gadget. Much more exciting.
Pete, what plans have you got for the future? Have you got anything planned for the future?
Well, on a personal front, I'm focusing more and more on sharing knowledge about these issues, about the sort of blended attacks that we're seeing, to try and get to people to realise that security is about humans, not products and gadgets, and that's my soapbox. That's what I'm trying to talk about at every opportunity. Professionally, my role for the future is to try and keep the First Space Technologies vision going, to make sure we are 100% ethical, that we remain pragmatic and business focused, so that we're not doing things because they prove what hairy chests we've got, but rather that they're actually genuinely useful to business, and to remain professional. And, you know, in terms of the ethical hacking arena, to just keep learning, I think it's a lifetime occupation, and it's loads of fun.
Yeah, I've said this before. I mean, it's such a great job that we have. It's like kids in a kid's store, in a sweet store. I mean, if you anything that you're interested in, it's our industry that you get to follow it to the bitter end and see what happens. And, you know, that's where I think we're probably very, very lucky to be in our profession.
Oh, I agree. Everybody I speak to say, oh, that sounds like a fantastic job. I wish I could do that.
Yeah, but...
Wish I could, of course, if they want.
Pete, is there anything that you kind of want to pimp for the HPR listeners? Have you got a blog or anything like that?
Yeah, my colleagues have dubbed me Famous Pete Wood Security, which is highly amusing and a good ribbing about my interest in being a media whore. I know you won't understand that yourself.
I have no understanding of being a media whore whatsoever at all, Mr. Woods.
So the FPWS, Famous Pete Wood Security blog is something that I try to use to get people to think about stuff. So that's on Blogspot, fpws.blogspot.com.
I'll link to it in the show notes as well.
And the other is our White Hats group, which is a free to join closed group for people interested in ethical hacking and information security in general. And that's something that has an active list that people seem to find useful. And we also run 4 meetings a year down in London on different interesting topics, which are just run at a cost-covering basis. So if people are interested in that, it's white-hats.co.uk.
Okay, and what people can join?
Anybody who works in the security industry, who's genuinely employed in security. We do a bit of vetting before we allow people to join. Journalists aren't allowed, and people who want to make a sales pitch aren't allowed. But otherwise, if they're working in or interested in information security, then they'll get membership.
Superb. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about, Pete?
I did think about a few points. I think one of the questions you asked me right at the beginning was advice for people who are interested in getting into this as a profession. And some of the points that we have to explain to people at interview or earlier in the recruitment process is that one of the key attributes, which you'll understand, I think, is patience. Because there's one thing about ethical hacking or any form of technical fault finding and engineering is panning for gold, really. You and I have to go through a lot of boring old rocks before you find the old gold nugget. And I don't think anybody realises that whilst this is a huge amount of fun, and by the time you're doing it as long as I have, you can, to some extent, pick and choose, I guess, it is an awfully tedious exercise for a proportion.
A lot of research. So a lot of time I spend reading.
Yeah. And it's, you know, if we're doing background research on a client or looking for a vulnerability in their human defences as much as their technical defences, it can take a very long time. And I guess it's also not necessarily, unless you're in a big firm, it's not something where you can hide behind a desk and just have your head buried the whole time. You do need a good command of your native language and good report writing skills, because unless you can put something together that actually explains to a often somewhat disinterested recipient and a non-technical recipient at the top of the tree exactly why it's an issue, what could happen to them realistically, not in hyperbole, understand the issues and how to fix them, then all the work's wasted, really. So I think my summary is you've got to be inquisitive in that childish engineer mode, you've got to be technically competent, you've got to be disciplined, and you've got to be a good communicator. And last but not least, you must be able to set your ego aside.
Brilliant. I think that's great advice. I mean, the ego aside parts, you know, I think for everyone involved in security, for people receiving, you know, security advice as well as people doing it, that ego is really something that should be left at the door. I mean, you can beat your chest after the event is done, but, you know, while we're doing it, it's, you know, it's not about being the cleverest and the biggest kid on the block. It's about securing our objectives and making those people secure.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, the last thing we want is someone who's so pleased with themselves that they start bragging about it in the pub that evening. The disappointing thing is you're really only going to discuss it with people who've signed an NDA with you.
Brilliant. Well, Pete, I'm going to wrap up the interview. I'd like to once again thank you very much for hopping on the line and talking to me. It's a very interesting time. I've enjoyed it very much. Is there anything you'd like to say to the Hacker Public Radio audience before we sign off?
Yeah, sure. Keep listening. This is such a great service, and I think Phoenix here is doing a great job. So big props to you, my friend.
There we go. That's my ego stroke for the day. And like I say, Pete, thank you very much. Thank you very much for listening, Hacker Public Radio listeners, and I'll catch you the next time on Phoenix Student Hacker's Guide to Linux.
Thank you for listening to Hacker Public Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.